Welcome everybody. Just before we get started, I just wanted to say that on Sunday, Hadar is having a sort of mini Yom Iyun on Sunday morning, New York time, to help people prep Pesach. Rav Tali Adler, Rav Avi Strasberg, Rav Eli Confer will all be teaching, and I think there are. Yeah, I think maybe somebody's giving a drush. I don't remember exactly what it is, but it'll be fun. So if you're looking for more things to do, you can just go to the Hadar homepage right now, and you can register to do this on Sunday, a little break from your Pesach panic. Or, I don't know, part of your Pesach panic, I suppose, depends on how you're feeling. Okay, so just so you know, that's coming up. Now, let's get back to our Mishnah. Last time we finished sort of in Mishnah 4, but we had to jump to Mishnah 6 in order to understand what was going on in Mishnah 4. So now we're going to be back in Mishnah 5. And recall that yesterday, I said that the things were playing out, like the odd biblical requirements in Exodus. The things like the offering can't leave your house. It has to be roasted and not boiled, etc., etc. So you have those things in mind from yesterday as we go on. We just finished saying that the core of the Pesach sacrifice, as opposed to other sacrifices, is to be eaten rather than to be offered. So Mishnah 5 is on that topic of the fact that it's... what other ramifications does it have to say that the core of the Pesach sacrifice is eating rather than offering? And this is it's just the Pesach that you has to be roasted on Seder night. That's the only requirement. The Korban Pesach has to be roasted. Everything else you can cook whatever you want on Pesach as long as it isn't chametz. Okay. So let's Mishnah 5. Mitma habasar v'achilev kayam, eino zorek et adam. Nitma hachilev v'habasar kayam, zorek et adam. So now we're wondering whether different parts of the sacrifice became impure, of the Pesach sacrifice. So if the flesh became impure, but the fat remained, then you shouldn't sprinkle the blood. In other words, you can't continue with the offering. Because the fat, the chalev, is forbidden to eat. And the only thing that is left that is pure is the thing which you can't eat. So essentially the whole offering is off because the meat itself that you could eat is impure. So there's no point continuing with the offering. It's over. You're done. But if the fat, which you couldn't eat anyway, becomes impure, but the flesh remains pure, then you can sprinkle the blood. You can continue on and have a totally fine sacrifice because at least you can eat it at the end. So this is another ramification of the fact that the eating is the core part of the Korban Pesach, as opposed to other sacrifices we're about to say. Uva mukdashin einochein. That's not true for other sacrifices, for other holy things. Ela af al pi shenitzma habasar v'achilev kayam zorek et adam. Even though the flesh was impure and but the fat remained pure, you would still sprinkle the blood because the chalev can be burnt. The fat can be burnt on the offering, so it doesn't impede the core of the sacrifice, which is to offer it on the altar, as opposed to in the case of the Pesach, where if the flesh became impure, it would invalidate the main point of doing it, and therefore you just stop there. You don't even continue on with the sacrifice. Okay, so that's just another ramification of the fact that the core of Pesach is eating as opposed to other sacrifices, which the core is to be offered, which here is expressed by the sprinkling of the dam that sort of seals the sacrifice. Okay, so we did this last time about Pesach Sheni. So now continuing on to Mishnah 7. HaPesach shenizrak damo v'achar kach noda shehu tamei hatzitz meratzeh. If you had a Pesach offering and the blood was already sprinkled, like it's already over, and afterwards you found out that the Pesach, the lamb you offered, was impure for some reason, then the tzitz can make it acceptable. The tzitz is the thing on the Kohen Gadol's head, And the seat sort of like covers you for messed up sacrifices. So basically this is like, yeah, the sacrifice got messed up, but there was no way you could do anything about it. It was totally out of your control. You had no idea that it was impure. And in that scenario, the tzitz can get you out of the situation, can make the sacrifice acceptable to God. Okay? The murat says, sort of make God want it, as the rot says, like the causal form of to want. Make it acceptable. But, nitma haguf ein hatzitz maratzeh. But if the person offering the sacrifice, which is here is expressed by the goof, the body, the person, the body of the owner, and you'll see why it has to be that in a second, ein hatzitz maratzeh, that then there's, if it turned out you already sacrificed the Pesach, you already sprinkled the blood, and then it turned out that the owner who brought the sacrifice was impure, maybe they touched a corpse, or they had a seminal emission or whatever, in that scenario, then you would the tzitz doesn't help you. The sacrifice was invalid. Nothing you could do about it. It was the responsibility of the person bringing the sacrifice to know that he was impure. So yeah, so you're out of luck. And then we're going to explain where this comes from. Mipnesha amru, because they said, this is the kind of thing which introduces some kind of oral text. The amru is a key feature there, where it's sort of like they said, they, the sages, like out there is this thing which has been said, but it seems to pre-exist the rest of this Mishnah here. Mipnesha amru, because they said, Hanazir ve'ose fesa hatzitz meratze al tumat adam ve'ein hatzitz meratze al tumat haguf. Because somebody who is a Nazirite or somebody who does the Pesach, the tzitz can make it acceptable if the sacrifice became impure, tumat hadam, but the tzitz will not make it acceptable if the person who brought it was impure. Now, the Nazirite here is somebody who brought the sort of you're a Nazirite for a certain number of days, you take a Nazirite oath, and then you would bring your sacrifice at the end of most commonly 30 days. But if you became impure at any time during that time, not only can you not bring the sacrifice, you have to restart your count. You have to go back to the beginning. If you touch a corpse, you have to go back to the beginning if you're a Nazirite count. So this is a situation where somebody brought their closing Nazirite offerings, and then it turns out that actually were in contact with a corpse but didn't notice, or other people didn't, or so they found out afterwards, after the fact, and therefore they were impure when they brought their sacrifices, then that would not, the tzitz does not make that sacrifice acceptable. They have to bring another one. Okay, so that's where this idea comes from. This seems to just be like an old oral tradition. It's not totally obvious what the reasoning is, but I think it's probably something about if the, like people should have more responsibility to know if they are impure than if an animal is impure. People just have more contact with what's going on for themselves. They have more responsibility over what's going on for themselves rather than what's going on for a random animal. Nitma tumat hatahom hatzitz meratzeh. And, but don't worry, in the case where you were made impure by tumat hatahom, which is the it's a nice phrase, it's the impurity of the deep. In other words, there was a corpse that was buried really far down that nobody knew was there, and that made you impure. And because, and then like they dug it up and found it, and you realized you'd walked literally over it or in the same enclosure, and you had no idea. In that situation, that's so far out of your control that the tzitz will help you out and make the invalid sacrifice accepted. So what I really like about this mission is sort of this idea that like sometimes God's got your back. If it turns out not ideal, the service that you were supposed to bring, there are situations where if that's not your fault and God will actually help you out, the Kohen Gadol tzitz will make sure that it is accepted even though it was invalid. And other times where you had more responsibility, you should have checked more carefully and then you're not off the hook. Mishnah 7, on to Mishnah 8. Nitma shalem or rubo, sorfin oto lifnei habira meyatze ha-ma'aracha. So now we're talking about what if the Pesach became impure, then it becomes what's called notar, which is leftover sacrifice, and you have to burn it. So that's what it says. If the entire thing or most of the sacrifice became impure, they burn it before the birah, which is some area in the temple, it seems, though there's some debate about that. from the wood that is arranged in the temple, the temple wood pile. It seems like because it's a sacrifice, you're already there, you can use the temple property for a sacred purpose of burning the notar. You can't use temple property for your own purposes, which is going to come up in a second. But it seems here, you found out... this is not notar, my mistake. This is... It becomes an invalid sacrifice, you have to burn it. But let's leave it that way, and then we'll come to the notar in a second. So if it was impure, all of it, or some of it, it's like you could do it in the temple courtyard, and you can use the temple wood. But nitma miuto b'han notar, but if only some of it, a minority of it, was impure, or it was left over after midnight on the 15th, sorfin oto b'chatzratehen or al gagatehan me'atzei atzman, then they burn it in their courtyards or on their houses, on their roofs, from their own wood. In other words, you're not allowed to take the temple wood home with you in order to burn your Pesach offering. Perhaps they're worried that you might end up with some wood left over and then you'll end up benefiting from temple property. It seems like if the entire thing or most of it becomes impure and you're right there in the temple, you can burn it right there. But if only some of it became impure or you get left over after midnight, then you can you should do it at home, and you don't get an out to use the temple wood. You have to use your own wood. And this is also a problem. Hatzaikin sorfin oto lefnei habira bishvil lehanot me'atzei ha'ma'arecha. There are actually these misers. They're narrow people. They have narrow minds here. They try to burn it in the temple courtyard in order to benefit from the wood. So they like, even if it's only some of the minority of it is impure or it's notar, they like bring it back to the temple and then like pretend that all of it became impure and then be able to use the temple wood in order not to have to use their own wood. So there are people who found a loophole to this thing of not using the temple wood. Great. That's one of the things about reading Mishnah. You realize that people have never changed, which is really, it's both terrifying and comforting. Let's continue. So now we're going to get to the situation of the Pesach, which left your house and what happened there, or it became impure in your house, as you'll see. Well, or it became impure anywhere, I guess. HaPesach sheyatza or shenitma yisareif miyad. If the Pesach left the house or it became impure, you burn it straight away. Okay, that's a situation where you just have to burn it on Yom Tov. You just have to get it out of there. It's a sacred thing that was made impure. You have to just get rid of it. Nitzma'u ha-ba'alim or shemetu tu'ubar tzurato v'yisareif b'shishasar. But the problem is not with the animals, but if the problem, the Pesach, with the meat, if the problem is with the owners, or so either they became impure or they died, then you let it rot, you let it, the image of the lamb, become disfigured. In other words, you let it lie there, and then you burn it on the 16th of Nisan. In other words, you wait until after Yom Tov. There's no reason to do it right then. You wait until Yom Tov is over and you burn it there. Normally, you can't burn Kodshim on Yom Tov, even though you can, because the only thing you're allowed to do really is to cook the meat that you're allowed, that you want for Yom Tov. You can cook the dishes that you want for Yom Tov. So there's lots of things you can't do, including burning Kodshim. But so here we're basically saying that if the Pesach itself is impure, you burn it straight away. But if it's a problem with the owners, then you wait until the 16th and burn it then. No, this is not with 2-day Yom Tovs. The 16th, if for us, it would be the 17th of, for us in the diaspora, it would be 17th of Nisan, not the 16th, right? The Pesach, the day of the Pesach is really the 14th of Nisan. It's not Yom Tov. Seder night begins the night of the 15th. That's Yom Tov. And then the 16th is not Yom Tov for them, but is for us. Okay. But there's a dissenting opinion. Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch Omer, Af ze yisareif miyad lefi she'ein lo ochlin. Actually, Rabbi Yochanan ben Rocha says that even if the problem was with the owners and not with the actual animal, that you would also burn immediately, superseding the normal rule of not burning Kodshim on Yom Tov. And the reason is because it's basically there's no one left to eat it. It's impossible that this sacrifice is going to be eaten. You'd rather not leave Kodshim just lying around. You want to burn it and be done with it. So he thinks that it does, in fact, you can do it on Yom Tov, because there's no one to eat the sacrifice. What happens if the Pesach was burned before eating the house full of the mitzvah? I don't know. You'd probably be in trouble. Okay. What we're learning in this section is there's a lot that could go wrong with your Pesach offering, so you might have to be very careful with it. But I think that it's pretty unlikely that if you lived in Jaffa, that you would go to Jerusalem to sacrifice your Pesach. It seems to me that you'd probably just sacrifice it at home, given that anyone can sacrifice it. This is describing the situation in Yerushalayim mainly. So I think in Yafo, you would just do it at home, in which case you'd keep it in your house. In Yerushalayim, you can take it to your house, and then it can't, because it can't leave the city walls, but it can go from the temple to your house in Yerushalayim. All the chavurah become impure. Yes, it means the chavurah, everyone who was registered for the lamb, everyone who had a stake in the Pesach, they became impure. That's correct. Or they died. Well, that's the thing, Sarah. Sometimes there are workarounds and sometimes there are not. Like, sometimes you're in trouble for Pesach and sometimes you can work things out. Okay. Ha'atzamot v'hagidin v'hanotar yisarfu v'shisha asar. The bones and the tendons and the things left over after midnight, they are burnt on the 16th. In other words, these things are things you didn't eat, the leftovers from the Pesach sacrifice. You don't burn them on the 15th, you wait until after Yom Tov, you burn them on the 16th. Chal shisha asar liyo b'shabbat, yisarfu b'shiv asar, lefi she'einan dochin lo et ha-shabbat v'lo et Yom Tov. But if the 16th fell on Shabbat, which it does this year, is that true? Or was that the 70th this year? No, the 70th is on Shabbat this year. Then you should wait until after Shabbat and burn it on the 17th, in order that because this burning will not, if you have to wait until after Yom Tov, you certainly can't do it on Shabbat. Burning on Shabbat is a much it's never really allowed except for in a very limited temple contexts. So if you can't do it on Yom Tov, you certainly can't do it on Shabbat. You have to let it sit, let the leftovers sit there until the 17th. Okay, let's keep going. We might be able to finish. Hopefully, we'll finish this chapter today, and then we'll see how it goes. Okay. Kol haneechal b'shor hagadol yachel bigdi harach v'rashei knafayim v'hashuchim. It's not a very common word. So there's a bunch of ways you can understand this Mishnah. I'm going to just translate it in the way that I think is probably the most likely and simplest way of understanding it. I think what we're talking about is, given that we know that you have to get a group of people registering for your Pesach, and each of the people registered have to have a certain amount of meat in order to eat it. They have to have like an olive's worth, a volume of an olive roughly. Then you have to work out which parts of the animal count towards that proportion, that divvying up, and which parts do not. So I think what we're saying is the way you work out how much of the lamb or goat is divvied up amongst the people in the minyan or the chavura. The way you do that is by comparing to what you would eat in a large ox. So anything which is eaten in a large ox shall be eaten with a soft goat. In other words, the Pesach offering is going to be a gdi harach. It's going to be a soft goat, and the exactly the parts of meat you might eat are different between those two animals, and some things which are soft now might harden later and be inedible. So you go by what things are edible in a large ox as opposed to the things in a small goat, and additionally you also include the literally, it's like the tips of the wings and the schusim, which is a cartilage, is on the ears and chest. You can also include those things which are eaten, which you can eat on a goat. As I said, there are a whole bunch of ways to understand this Mishnah, and that's one way. It's a difficult Mishnah here, but there are definitely other ways you can understand it if you looked up in some commentaries. And now we're going to start talking about another important topic, which is another thing you can't do with the Pesach sacrifice, which is breaking a bone. You cannot break any bones of the Pesach, according to the Book of Shemot. Hashover et ha'etzem b'Pesach ha'tahor harei ze lokeh arba'im. So one who breaks the bone of a pure Pesach offering, that person is lashed 40 times. That's just a way of saying they violated a negative commandment from the Torah. So they're lashed 40 times. That's just like, that's the straight up, what when the Torah says you cannot break the bones of Pesach offerings, that's what it means. It means pure Pesach offerings. That's what it's talking about. Aval hamotir batahor v'hashover batameh eino lokeet arba'in. But anything which is left over from, like bones that are left over from a tahor Pesach, from a pure Pesach, or one who breaks the bones of an impure Pesach, that person is not lashed. That's not enough. Now, I'm not sure this is necessarily, they're saying, therefore you can break as many bones as you like. It might be saying, rather, that even though you still should, ideally shouldn't break those bones that are either left over from a pure sacrifice or from an impure sacrifice, you shouldn't ideally break those bones, but if you did, you can't be punished by the Torah for it. That's not the main case the Torah is talking about. Can you break the bones of non-Pesach offerings? Absolutely yes, which we're about to see in a second. Why? Good question. Yeah, good question. Okay, I don't have a good answer to it, but we could find some commentaries on the Torah and maybe we'll find a good answer. Okay. Next Mishnah. As we'll see, we'll answer the question about breaking the bone of non-Pesach offerings. Ever sheyatza mikzato choteich ad shemagia la'etzem v'kolef ad shemagia la'perek v'choteich. So now we have a case where the sacrifice is mostly indoors, but some of it, just like a little bit of the leg or something, went outside the threshold. So that part of the sacrifice is now invalid. What are you supposed to do? Can you still eat the rest of it? The threshold of your house, as in like your door, like a little left, went out the door or the window, or outside the walls of Jerusalem, and then that part is no longer edible. What do you do in order to remove it, given that you can't break any bones? Okay, so the answer is you cut until you get to the bone, and then you pare away until you get to the joint, and then you cut that instead. So you can sort of cut the fat and the cartilage instead of the bone in order to get rid of that limb so that it doesn't contaminate the rest of the offering. But uva mukdashin kotzeitz bakopis she'ein bo mishum shvirat ha'etzem. But if you with other sacrifices, with other holy things, you can actually just chop it with a butcher's cleaver. Totally fine, because there is no prohibition of breaking bones. On other sacrifices. Were houses very small? Probably by our standards, yes. Maybe by New York apartments, no. But also they might have had large houses, but with a lot of people in the house. No, the bone is sticking out of the house. That, the question, the word here, yatsa, in the Mishnah, comes directly from the Torah about when the Pesach leaves your house. So that's how you know that's what this is talking about, because as soon as it leaves the house, it becomes invalid. Okay, now we're going to define what counts as inside or outside the house, which also tells you what's going on. Min ha'agaf v'lifnim kilifnim. Min ha'agaf v'lachutz kilachutz. So from the doorstop or the what's it called, the doorpost, inwards, that's then it's like inside. From the doorpost outwards, it's like outside. So in other words, it's the inner boundary. It's certainly by accident, by the way. This is certainly by accident. You didn't like intentionally put the animal out of the house. It just, you were carrying the animal around and like a limb went out the window or something like that, or outside the door. Basically, like the first instance of the door, anything beyond that is outside. Anything inside of the first part of the door is inside. That's for a house. But for the walls of Jerusalem, hachalonot v'ovei hachoma kilifnim. Windows, but their windows are not made of glass. Their windows are literally just holes in the wall. So windows and the thickness of the wall, all of that is inside. So it has to actually go beyond the boundary of the wall, beyond the thickness of the wall in order to count as outside the city wall. But if it just goes beyond the inside of the door in a house, then it is outside the house. Okay. We're going to finish the chapter. It's going to be good. Okay. Shtei chavurot shehayu ochlin bevayit echad. Eilu hofchin et pneihen helach v'ochlin, ve'eilu hofchin et pneihem helach v'ochlin, v'hamecham ba'emtza. Now you have a case of what happens if, as we talked about their houses, there might be a lot of people in these houses, you actually had a house Where they had, because the Torah imagines that it's sort of one lamb per household, and you can sort of invite people to your house. But what happens if you have one house where there are two groups registered for two different Pesachs eating together in the same house? You might want to, though, by the way, bayit can sometimes mean room. So it might be talking specifically about the people if they're in the same room. That's probably what we're talking about. Many houses are probably essentially one room. The question is, how do we make sure that no one is confused about which sacrifice they are eating of, or like to make sure that it's clear that which group has which sacrifice? So the solution is, if you have two groups which are eating in one house, one group turns their faces one way and eats, the other one turns their faces the other way and eats, and the mecham is in the middle, the heater, the thing that you can heat the I don't know, the hot plate or the fire or something like that, is in the middle. So they can share their it could be a heater, like just a way to make it more comfortable. They can share their cooking apparatus or their heating apparatus, but they have to be sure to not be not be confused to be in the same group. They have to be in separate parts of the house, sort of facing other opposite directions. Okay. Uchasher hashamash omeid limzog kofetz et piv umachazir et panav ad shemagia etzel chavurato v'ochel. Now we have a situation where one of the people in one of those groups is a servant, is a shamash, is a sort of waiter at a meal. So he has to go and serve both groups, but he's only technically registered for one of them. So when he goes to the other group to serve them, what does he have to do in order to make it clear that he is in fact not in that group? In that such circumstance, When the waiter stands to mix, the limzog is to mix wine cups. Their wine was sort of syrupy. You had to mix it with water in order to drink it. So that's just like a normal way that you would talk about like having a fancy meal with wine. Though obviously you have 4 cups of wine. So that's what kind of thing the waiter would do. What he can do is he closes his mouth, turns his face away until he arrives back at his group, and then he can eat, and that's fine. So in other words, he like has to close his mouth, so he doesn't seem to be sort of like, you know, getting any of the scent of their offering. He has to sort of like close off any entranceway to their offering, so he's not benefiting from it in any way, and also turn his face around, so to do it sort of, maybe you can pour the wine over here and then give it to them in order to not face the group. And then you can go back and eat with his own group. And also, the hakala hofechet et paneha v'ochelet. And the bride, it seems like the bride might be sort of self-conscious about eating in front of other people. That seems to be the case here. She can certainly sit with a group, but she would have to, she can also keep her face out of the way, turn her face and eat it. She doesn't have to be facing the group. She can sort of look after her own modesty her own way. The servant could be a Jew. It doesn't have to be a Gerit. Yes, Jews work on the Chag, 100%. Rabbis work on Chagim all the time. And you work out a situation where they're not being paid for it at all, or they're not being paid for that day. But yeah, for sure. Somebody has to serve the meal, like that's clear. Okay. See you soon.